How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
Has it been a week already? Well, you know what we do around here when we get to Friday. We bring you our weekly news recap with the top stories that you need to know about. Stories like these.
The deputy mayor is a black woman. Department of Planning and Development is a black woman.
The U.S. Justice Department launched an investigation into the city of Chicago and its hiring practices.
It centers on whether discrimination is at play inside City Hall.
Even before this latest batch of agreements, the city had blown through the $82 million it had budgeted this year for police misconduct-related cases.
Chicago man accused in the deadly shooting of two Israeli embassy employees in Washington.
He approached a group of four people, produced a handgun, and opened fire, striking both of our decedents.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Here to break down the latest for us, we had Nick Blumberg, correspondent for WTTW News and host of Chicago Tonight Week in Review, Alden Lowry, data projects editor for WBEZ. And for the first time on the news recap, we had Chicago Sun-Times investigative reporter Robert Hergeth. Some Chicago City Council news in a moment, but first, 31-year-old Chicagoan Elias Rodriguez has been charged with fatally shooting two staff members of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., Sarah Milgram and Yaron Leshinsky. He's also confessed to the crime, which took place outside the Capitol Jewish Museum Wednesday night. When he was taken into custody, he allegedly told police, quote, "I did it for Palestine." FBI agents searched his home in Albany Park on the northwest side yesterday. And now, since WTTW's studios are close to Albany Park, we began by asking Nick what he could tell us about the neighborhood and what's been happening there over the last 24 hours. Here's Nick.
The FBI descended. There were many, many agents outside the accused shooter's home, the 4700 block of North Troy. For folks who are familiar with the Brown Line, you know, going in the direction of Kimball, that stop, that end of the line is in Albany Park.
Okay.
So Lawrence Avenue, think about that kind of running through uptown along the lake. You go about 4 miles west, you're in Albany Park. It is one of the most ethnically diverse neighborhoods in the city, has one of the highest populations of folks born outside the United States. So it is, you know, not necessarily on everyone's radar, but it is, you know, a very multi-ethnic and really interesting, you know, neighborhood there.
Yeah. As Nick mentioned there, Bob, the FBI has been searching the confessed shooter's apartment. So lots of action there. What might they be looking for?
Sure. I mean, obviously, we don't know exactly at this point, but in general, they would be looking for any sort of digital records, manifesto type things, communications. Is there an accomplice, let's say? As well as any sort of physical evidence like a gun or any other weaponry. So I'm sure by now, you know, they know what they have, presumably, although there also could be some forensic investigation into computers or hard drives and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what else do we know? The confessed shooter got a bachelor's degree from the University of Illinois Chicago back in 2018. He had an administrative job with a healthcare trade association, and he was vocal on social media about his opposition to Israel's bombing of Gaza. WBEZ and the Sun-Times were continuing to report on his background. What more do you think we could find out, Alden and Nick?
One of the things I think is interesting about this is he is among a very large chorus of people who have been spoken opposition to what's been happening in Gaza. But I don't know if we've seen anyone go through the lengths that he did here and striking out the way that he did. Even saying free Palestine before committing, allegedly committing these murders. And I think that's an issue not just for understanding this particular case, but I think it's also an issue for anyone who's pretty much on that side of this this longstanding debate about how we handle things over there and how they're being handled and how Israel is operating. If this is the way people are expressing their dissent to those actions, then that's certainly a problem.
Yeah, and I think this is already such a heated and complicated conversation about whether opposition to Israel, whether anti-Zionism is the same in every instance as anti-Semitism, which there is, you know, obviously there's a lot of pushback from folks who say these sorts of chants, these sorts, obviously this sort of an attack is anti-Semitic, but there are also people even within the Jewish community who say, well, it's not necessarily to criticize Israel and to criticize actions, but when there is such a horrific and violent attack like this, that just turns up the heat on an already incredibly polarized conversation.
A member of Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker's staff was also at that museum event in D.C., but was unharmed. The governor, who is Jewish, said, quote, "Make no mistake, this was an attack on the Jewish community." So this is clearly a national story, folks, that is resonating here at home. Now, I want to pivot to Chicago City Council because we've got a lot on our docket today. After a years-long struggle over curfew laws, Alders delayed a vote on a measure giving police more power to impose curfews. Alden, we've been talking about this back and forth for quite some time. What exactly was being proposed? Remind us of that, and why no vote?
So what was being proposed was essentially expanding the city's curfew, granting the authority of the superintendent of police. And the measure initially called for the superintendent and the deputy mayor for public safety, Garian Gatewood, to mutually agree that a curfew was needed to deal with teen takeovers. This is all about how the city kind of manages that and lowers the potential for violence. There have been two takeovers that have taken place, both in March, that were people were wounded by gunfire. And so this kind of born out of that, I think, initially proposed by Alderman Brian Hopkins. So we're getting close to a vote, but the proposal was changed to essentially grant Superintendent Snelling kind of unilateral
like
authority
the power,
to within thirty minutes notice to kind of call for a snap curfew, and then there's no limitation on the coverage of how widespread that curfew could be imposed. So it's coming up for a vote. 17 alders essentially signed onto a parliamentary move to delay that vote until the June 18 city council meeting, and so we stand there. Alderman Hopkins is confident that the measure will pass. The question, though, is that if 17 alders vote, are expressing their dissent here in this form, if they do vote against this measure and it still passes, but the mayor vetoes it, there would be one more vote needed in order to override that veto.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the mayor because I want to play a little bit of what he had to say about the curfew measure.
Do I have concerns? Of course I do. You know, but, you know, the, you know, historic nature of what we're confronting is going to take all of us collectively to ensure that we are addressing and approaching this matter in the fullness of all of the experiences that the people of Chicago have had.
Yeah, not a ton of detail there from the mayor, Nick. Where exactly does he come down on this curfew
proposal?
That's
a polite way of putting it. That's a great question. You know, the answer that we heard this week, as we just heard that selection from, was a little vague, perhaps deliberately vague. Maybe he doesn't want to tip his hand. Maybe he doesn't want to have to veto this measure. Might be trying to work behind the scenes and doesn't want to, you know, get too much out ahead of himself in public. You know, previously he has expressed doubt about the constitutionality of this ordinance, which other folks on the city council, other legal experts have as well, basically saying like this is an overstep of police authority. So we've heard him, you know, air those concerns before. It'll be curious to see if he gets more vocal when this comes back up for a vote. But, you know, it's interesting. The police already have this mass arrest policy that they put in place before the DNC, which they say they used, you know, pretty successfully. So, you know, there have been folks who have been sort of questioning why is this snap curfew measure necessary? Why is this the right step?
Yeah, we often see more teen gatherings as it warms up. Now, I mean, if you look outside or if you've been outside recently, it probably doesn't feel that way. It doesn't feel very warm right now. But we do know this is a long weekend, right? Memorial Day weekend is our unofficial, if you will, kickoff to the summer. Have city officials said, Alden, how they plan on handling any big gatherings at this point?
I wouldn't say there have been like any kind of very firm announcements of this is exactly how we're going to handle it. I think the mayor said this, that the objective really is to kind of steer teens away from having the gatherings altogether. However, they have one approach that they are kind of exploring is connecting with community organizations and having them actually on site downtown when they think a gathering might occur or when it's just beginning to occur, mm-hmm. and kind of acting as a buffer in some way in terms of talking with teens, advising them, you know, helping them figure out what is it that you're here for, what would you like to do, here's a way to do that, and then, you know, also obviously trying to kind of mitigate any kind of things that might brew. These things are planned, mm-hmm. By teens in a very informal way, but they're using social media often to talk,
yeah.
and kind of get up interest to do it. But you never know when it's gonna actually happen.
Right.
And it could be cold on one Friday, and then on Saturday the weather is great, and you could conceivably have one of these very, you know, kind of.
Right.
Things happen almost instantaneously.
And there's so much talk about all these teen trends or teen takeovers, you know, the ones that go violent. But as a parent, I do want to shout out the teens that are just hanging out.
Well, and there was a really...
doing nothing.
Yeah.
And just being good kids.
There was an interesting piece in the Tribe the other day that sort of got to that point that, like, there aren't necessarily these third spaces like a mall that, you know, we used to be able to hang out and just
exactly.
sort of like walk around and get a gross pretzel and like, you know, sit at the
right.
food court and hang out with your friends for 4 hours.
Cinnabon.
Yeah, exactly.
Cinnabon, Nick.
Yeah. So, you know, it is an issue. Teens want to gather. Young yeah. people want to hang out.
Yeah. And there's no place like downtown.
Absolutely.
I mean, the malls have their appeal, the ones, you know, out in the suburbs, but there's nothing like downtown. There's an energy, there's
yeah.
an electricity that you feel there. In the same way that older folks enjoy it, teens enjoy it as well.
Exactly.
And so they want to be a part of that. And the other thing, too, is that there are literally hundreds of them during these takeovers. The violence that we've seen really boils down to a handful of people. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the reasons why some alders have been opposed to
that's
this
right.
curfew measures,
mm-hmm.
saying that this is
like
a way
you're
of,
punishing all. Yeah.
And you're essentially kind of criminalizing Black and Latino youth in particular, who are often there for these things.
Yeah, Bob, I saw you smiling there. Were you reminiscing on some times hanging out downtown?
In the old days, when I was in high school hanging out at the beach with a group, the cops, the Chicago cops would show up with their billy clubs. They'd pull them out and say, "Who wants to go swimming?"
Oh,
that's how they handled it in the old days.
All right. I'll keep you in the hot seat there, Bob. The city council is also considering a measure that would force landlords to provide reasons when they don't renew a lease. What's the fine print?
Right. It's interesting. So this is something that other cities and other states have adopted. And this is something that's been proposed in the past here that's gone nowhere. And what this is aimed at sort of is, well, I mean, the issue of gentrification, but also of what they describe as stabilization of a community, of a building, of a neighborhood or a part of a neighborhood where, say, working class people have lived in a building for years or decades, and now they have a new owner maybe,
mm-hmm.
and the rents are either going up or they're converting to condos. And so what happens to the long-term tenants? And so so it's a really very interesting debate and a long-standing one. I mean, again, you know, housing has been a huge issue in Chicago forever. I mean, my dad, who was a journalist years ago, wrote about Lou Wolfe, if you remember that name.
Okay.
He was like a total slumlord who died a few years ago.
Oh,
but,
wow.
you know, just you know, horrible buildings and stuff like that. And obviously, you know, the whole redlining issue and stuff. So housing and real estate has always been a very important issue and a polarizing one, and one that's punished the poor and minority neighborhoods in particular. So what here is an attempt to sort of curb that and create some sort of, you know, venue and opportunity for residents to take some power away from landlords
yeah.
that are behaving badly, basically.
Sticking with city council, alders approved paying more than $62.5 million to resolve 4 police misconduct lawsuits. What stands out to you most from these cases, Alden?
The thing that stands out the most to me is the fact that most of these cases, or at least the largest sum of that $62 million, are around wrongful convictions.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been a pattern with, you know, I know we've heard of course, going back to the John Birch torture cases and things of that nature, misconduct. But a number of these cases in more recent years, I think it's $256 million since 2019, are essentially settlements due to wrongful convictions that were based mm-hmm. on evidence collected by CPD officers. And so
there's a pattern.
Yeah. And the most egregious of this $62.5 million is a $48 million settlement for three men who were wrongfully convicted for committing a fire that resulted in two people dying, and they spent a combined 102 years in prison behind the wrongful conviction. So that's an element of what's happening mm-hmm. here that's costing taxpayers a great deal of money.
Yeah, and to that end, just 5 months into this year, and the city of Chicago has spent more than its annual budget for police misconduct lawsuits. Bob, how can the city continue to pay these settlements?
It can't. I mean, you know, when Alden and I used to work together at the BGA, one of our colleagues did a great analysis. This is going on 10, 12 years ago, and I think the tally at that time to that date over the previous maybe decade was, I think, $500 million yeah. that the city had paid on wow. wrongful conviction settlements, but also I think it was legal fees. It was whatever it was a heck of a lot of money. And that was 10, 12 years ago. This, you know, this can't keep continuing. But, you know, putting aside the financial costs, what always I try and, you know, when I look at these issues and I hear these, you know, the payments and stuff, I try to put the money aside and also look at the human costs. I mean, the human costs are tremendous, not just for the person who might be in prison wrongly, you know, yeah. wrongly convicted and the horror of being incarcerated, you know, needlessly, but also to the community that was victimized by whatever crime occurred in that family, and then maybe the real killers walking in the streets committing mm-hmm. other things. So it's just the ripple effect of these is massive. And the last thing I'd say about that is this is a legacy problem. You know, not that this started with this mayor, the last mayor, blah, 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 but under Mayor Daley, you know, this was this a lot of this originated under his regime, and the cops were, you know, arguably out of control in a lot of ways. And nothing. And so now we're paying for the sins of the past currently.
Mm. Yeah. And Chicago is certainly not alone in struggling with police misconduct. This Sunday marks the fifth anniversary of George Floyd's murder by a police officer. On Wednesday, the Department of Justice announced it's ending the police reform agreements known as consent decrees in Minneapolis, where Floyd was killed, and Louisville, where Breonna Taylor was killed that same summer. In other cities as well. Now, Chicago's consent decree is going to remain in effect, but I'm wondering just around the room how you all think that these White House actions could impact police reform efforts here in our city.
Well, I mean, on the one hand, these are the sorts of things that you see when there's a, you know, a partisan change, you know, that presidents bring in different priorities. They want a DOJ leader to you know, have different, you know, reflect their mindset. But I do think something like this, you know, it creates a tenor that, you know, it creates, you know, perhaps a mindset among local officials, among, you know, police officers and their leaders that we're not facing the kind of scrutiny that we were 3, 4, 5 years ago. We're mm-hmm. not facing the kind of public outcry for reform. And to, you know, to Bob's point about whether, you know, police behaving badly and the legacy of those effects, you have to wonder whether a pullback in reform efforts, a pullback in oversight could be, you know, sort of creating a new crop of misconduct cases.
Mm-hmm. A defiant Mayor Johnson is saying he's not intimidated by the DOJ opening an investigation into his hiring practices, which the government alleges are racially biased. Here's what Johnson had to say about President Trump.
He's a monster. Period. We have the most diverse administration in the history of Chicago. And he is threatened by that. You can tell when someone is fearful is because they act out. We have a president that is screaming and having tantrums right now because we have an administration that reflects the city of Chicago, but he would much rather have administrations that reflect the country club.
Nick, why are the president and DOJ opening this investigation?
So this came after some Johnson remarks on Sunday at Pastor Byron Brazier's church. You know, Johnson's been visiting particularly black churches across the city in recent months. And he said, you know, he was touting the number of black officials that are in city leadership, that are mm-hmm. in his cabinet, basically saying this is a way to correct historic wrongs. This is a way to make sure that my administration is reflective of the demographics of the city. Mm-hmm. This remark quickly blew blew up online. It got the attention of the DOJ. And just a day later, they sent a letter saying they're opening an investigation into basically, you know, whether Johnson's hiring practices are unfairly favorable to black people.
But is this any different than what he was saying when he first got elected or when he was running? I think this has kind of been his message.
This is sort of a continuation of his, you know, anti-woke, you know, crusade that he and other Trump officials have been on, saying that this has gone too far. We need to step in. This is discriminatory. You know, Johnson kind of turned it around. You know, we heard in that clip, my administration reflects the country. His reflects the country club.
Yeah.
Said they should be investigating the Trump cabinet, which does have one black person and two Latinos, and everyone else is white.
Yeah. What's behind that smile, Alden? What do you make of the government's argument there and how Johnson's fighting back in this case?
I find this all very comical. The president and the administration's pushback to DEI, and there was a lot of this even during his first administration, I think very much an overreach. But the underlying all of this, I think, is this sense that the presence of the prominence of people of color in positions of authority in and of itself requires scrutiny because
how could that be?
Exactly. And even when the plane accident happened at the D.C. airport earlier this year, one of the culprits that the president mentioned was DEI.
Immediately.
Without any, correct me if I'm wrong here, but none of the people involved, the actual principals involved in that crash, were people of color or women or anyone else who supposedly benefit from DEI.
And that was an assumption made like really quickly, too. Yeah. Like the plane had just gone down.
Mm-hmm. So I think there's a thread underneath the imposition that there has been a wrongdoing here, that people have been discriminated against. And underneath that is essentially this implicit notion that people of color are not qualified for these high ranking or important positions. And that is deeply troubling.
I mean, it goes back to messages we heard when Kamala Harris became the Democratic nominee. You know, you heard Republican members of Congress essentially calling her a DEI hire, as though she had no political resume to speak
of. Not essentially, they said it directly.
Right.
Yeah. Time to turn to Chicago's newest celebrity. I'm talking about Pope Leo XIV, of course. Now, Bob, a defrocked priest with several allegations of child molestation. He says the Pope approved moving him to a monastery near a school.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Yeah. This was 25 years ago. So Pope Leo was not Pope Leo then. He was Robert Prevost, who was the leader of the Augustinian order in the Chicago region in the Midwest, actually. And just before he would be elevated to be the top Augustinian leader internationally around the globe. So when the Augustinians are a religious order, there's hundreds of religious orders that sort of comprise just little pockets of the Catholic Church, who is a Catholic priest. But anyway, there was an archdiocesan priest, so not an Augustinian, who had been accused of multiple allegations of abuse, and they have been deemed credible over the years, and he needed a place to be put on ice, so to speak. And so the cardinal at the time, Francis George, his regime put out word, what I'm told, to a variety of different Catholic organizations with potential housing. Hey, can anybody take this guy in? They were upfront, I believe, about, you know, the allegations. And the Augustinians responded, said, sure. And we know this in part because there was documentation and some data dumps over some church lawsuits that were settled. So we've known that Prevost was part of signing off on this. And then recently, over the past week, I and a colleague also spoke to him at separate occasions, this priest, former Father Jim Ray, and he confirmed that, Prevost had signed off on him living at this monastery run by the Augustinians on the south side. And that in and of itself isn't necessarily bad. People, if people need to be watched, they need to house somewhere. But the problem was that it's literally maybe 100 feet from a Catholic grade school and across the alley from a child care center, neither of which that I could find were notified at the time.
And that makes me wonder if it's going to raise questions about the Pope's future handling of crises within the Catholic faith.
Right. Well, and you know, I mean, a lot of people, so the Augustinian Order came out with a very sort of strong, aggressive defense of the Pope, and it was boiled down to one reader that I talked to summed it up as blame the dead guy, because Cardinal George is deceased, and they sort of laid it on his lap as in trying to kind of, which again, I'm not saying he doesn't bear some responsibility, but did Robert Prevost bear some responsibility and or others within his order? And, you know, I think the answer is yes. Mm. And so he's getting heat for that and has not directly, that I know of, responded to it as of yet. Certainly not to us, and we've tried repeatedly.
Advocates for abuse survivors also say that Pope Leo mishandled abuse allegations as a bishop in Peru. I want to play a little bit of what Peter Isley of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests had to say.
This is the side of him and his management and his decisions that we're finally being able to bring to light, because it's about the whole man. That's what's important. And what we care about is what he has done or not done about the sexual abuse of children.
And so what exactly are they accusing the Pope of?
Well, kind of somewhat similarly in Peru, because he was this Prevost is from Chicago and ministered here, but also was in Peru for many years, and he was a bishop down there. And there were some allegations from some children of abuse by a different priest, and that he had allegedly mishandled it. I think that those facts are still being worked out. Mm-hmm. But at least in my mind, I'm not an expert in what's going on in Peru. But I will tell you this, what this kind of hints at and shows the larger picture and the backdrop to all this is it sort of gives lie to the narrative out of the U.S. that the abuse scandal is over. You know, I mean, Supich, our cardinal here, so the top cleric here, is all but said, you know, well, this is sort of an old issue and we need to move on, almost in those words, and which to survivors and victims is pretty insulting, because the church doesn't get to decide, they do, when to move on. But also this fact that, you know, is the abuse as rampant as it was in the 80s and 90s in the U.S.? Probably not. Mm-hmm. But in the developing world, it is believed to be absolutely out of control, and that there is crisis brewing there currently as we speak.
Well, in order to bolster up the support for abuse victims, this group is asking to establish a global truth commission. They want him to adopt a zero tolerance law on child abuse and create a reparations fund. So, any response from Pope Leo or a spokesperson to the allegations?
I mean, locally there's been some response, not necessarily to us, but in other media accounts. But you know, one thing that I would point out is that the new Pope has, had different speaking engagements and spoken about Ukraine, spoken, I believe, about Gaza, mm-hmm. spoken about migrants and immigrants and stuff like that. To my knowledge, at least that I have seen, I mean, forgive me if this has come up in the past, you know, few hours or something, but that not that I've seen, has he addressed this in any sort of forceful way, which raises questions about priorities.
We've got other news involving the Pope, Alden. Last week, we talked about his modest childhood home being taken off the market to be sold at auction to the highest bidder. And now, different news. We're learning that the south suburb of Dalton has some other plans. What do they want to do?
Well, the city of Dalton would like to essentially acquire the home. And there's a potential controversy with that. But they'd like to acquire the home and essentially use it as a way to honor the Pope and to benefit the village. It could be very much a draw for tourism, or at least for folks who would visit on some form of fashion there. It could be a nice little jewel for the village, a village that's struggling to bring not only residents there, but to bring business and commerce and visitors.
So. Yeah, so they want to purchase it either from the current owner or through eminent domain.
Through eminent domain, yeah. The village's attorney threw that out as a possibility, which could be interesting. The owner has said that he's open to negotiating with the village around it. The village has said that they would offer a fair market price, and I think that's a very interesting thing here. It was bought by the owner for $66,000, I believe, last last year. Renovated the home, put it on the market for just under $200,000. I don't think there's been a whole lot of interest, but better believe there's a lot of interest now.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it might be a win for the community. I mean, all I've heard is challenges in recent years from Dalton, you know, questionable spending. When you think about the former mayor, Tiffany Henyard, yes. Federal investigations into what she was doing, sinking real estate prices there. What do you think, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, this is a part of Chicagoland and, you know, a village in particular that has faced, you know, tough economic times, has faced, you know, issues with, you know, deteriorating housing, deteriorating, you know, infrastructure, trying to draw people to live there or to stay there. So, yeah, I think if you're the new mayor there and the, you know, the Tiffany Henyard era has ended, she's also no longer the local township supervisor.
Right.
I think there is a lot of interest in trying to move past that. Although, yes, as you mentioned,
you've got the Pope's house and right. You can do that, you know, whatever maybe, you want with it.
Maybe the excitement around the new pontiff outweighs the pending FBI investigation.
the Dalton Village attorney said that Pope Leo being from there could be seen as divine intervention. Mm. That was a quote for the troubles in that south suburb. Would you expect papal tourism in Dalton, Bob?
I would. I mean, you're already seeing it. I mean, you're seeing people coming from all over, driving just to take a little peek at the house and take a photo. There's also a church up the street before this all transpired, I was actually doing research on some kind of dilapidated churches, and that was one of them. And it's turned out that you know, could be redeveloped too, although right. There was a redevelopment plan in the works that was a little iffy, but that could now be propelled. And also with the Red Line extension not too far away, that could spur some development too.
Yeah. The White Sox also unveiled a mural of Pope Leo in the very spot where he watched the team go against the Houston Astros in game one of the World Series back in 2005.
And the Sox can take all the help they can get.
I will have to say, the one thing that I just think was a missed opportunity was the prospect of Tiffany Henyard meeting the pontiff. I wish we could have had that moment.
The super mayor and the Pope.
Oh, sounds like a great time to turn to statewide politics.
Be a podcast.
I would listen.
The Super Mayor and the Pope podcast. Okay, Congresswoman Lauren Underwood. Well, she's saying that she's running again for her seat in the House. And that means, well, she's not going to run to replace Dick Durbin. How's the Senate race shaping up, Nick?
Well, it is still a three-way race between two of her colleagues in the delegation, Raja Krishnamoorthy and Robin Kelly. And, you know, so I think the fact that there is, you know, and of course, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, I think, you know, the speculation had been running pretty rampant, you know, right around the time of Dick Durbin's announcement that he was retiring as to whether she would jump in the race. Mm-hmm. When it got to be 3 weeks, almost a month, and we hadn't heard anything, I think it kind of had swung the other way. And she did finally come out this week and say, look, I'm in the House. I'm in leadership. Yeah. I'm working with the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. We want to try to retake the House. And of course, you know, the first midterm election after a president's, you know, a new president comes in is often a good time for the opposition party, especially one with, you know, 51%-ish disapproval ratings. You also have to wonder if she just made the calculation that, like, this field is already crowded.
It is pretty crowded.
And there's
crowded.
Already two candidates, you know, Raja Krishnamoorthy with $20 million in the bank and Stratton with Pritzker behind her.
Going to say with the governor backing her. So maybe, you know, be smart and just say, I'll set this one out.
Yeah. And there have already been six Democrats announcing that they're not going to run next year in the House. And three of them, you know, here in Illinois.
It's like, I might have a better chance over there. You're going to be in Springfield next week. Saturday the 31st is the deadline to pass the state budget. Top issues that you're expecting lawmakers to be contending with?
Well, I think that $3.2 billion budget gap is top of mind.
That
old thing. And oh, by the way, the $500 million in revenue that we have now revised downward. In addition to the budget, there are a lot of questions right now. Obviously, the fiscal cliff facing transit next year, $770 million. Are they going to reform
They're
oversight?
They're asking for $1.5 billion.
Good luck, friends. There are a lot of, you know, education issues too. What are funding levels going to look like for K-12 with COVID money running out? Are they going to ban cell phones in classrooms? The mayor went down with a sort of smaller list of priorities, interested to see whether he gets those, like the 911 surcharge, more shelter funding. But, you know, kind of overall, I'm going to be looking at, you know, how long does this take? How much do they walk it right up to the deadline? And how well run is this process? Yeah. Last year, we saw it take, you know, 3 votes before they had enough folks to clear that.
So do you think they'll meet this May 31st deadline?
Well, I think they have a lot of pressure to do so. You know, historically, they have gotten it done, but they walk it right up to the end. And I don't think this year is going to be any different.
The Chicago Sky had their home opener last night. Anybody watch?
Saw the clips.
Nope. This comes on the heels, though, of forward Angel Reese expressing gratitude for the WNBA's support. This was after receiving racist taunts last weekend at an Indiana Fever game. Fill us in on what happened there, Alden.
Yeah, so the Sky were taking on the Fever. It was the season opener, and it was in Indiana there, in Indianapolis. And so going in, this was already a big game. Mm-hmm. There's the rivalry between Reese and Caitlin Clark of the Fever, and consequently the rivalry between the Sky and the Fever. I remember there was a teammate of Angel Reese's that got into a confrontation with Caitlin Clark a year ago. A lot of hay was made of that. So this was a marquee matchup. While the game's going on, at various moments throughout the game, there were racial slurs and other very derogatory racially sensitive messages that were uttered by members of the crowd directed at Reese. And particularly there was a moment during the game when Reese and Clark had a physical confrontation. Mm-hmm. I think Reese cleared out a teammate of Clark's on for a rebound.
Yes.
Grabbed a rebound, and then Clark shoved Reese, got charged with a flagrant foul. And in the aftermath of that, they say this was the most intense moment when you heard a lot of that kind of talk coming from people in the crowd. Mm-hmm. And so the WNBA is investigating, and there was an outpouring of support for Reese in the aftermath of that. Although in the press conference after the game, she really kind of brushed it off, just kind of wanted to move on.
They both kind of did. Yeah. And Caitlin Clark, we should say, also has spoken up in addition to the WNBA to say, like, you know, that type of thing, hate is not tolerated here. There's no space for that in this league. But I'm curious what you think the WNBA's responsibility is here. Should they be doing more to protect players from this kind of abuse?
I think they should. This is a moment where I think if the WNBA needs cover to really kind of dig in on this rivalry, these two particular young stars in this moment gives them cover to really get into this, because this isn't a problem that just happened this past weekend. I mean, this is an element not only in games that you attend in Indiana, not only in WNBA, but in sporting theaters, in many venues across the country. I don't think we ever hear quite enough about it. Players, it's just kind of a part of the game. Mm-hmm. But you've had moments when there's been some back and forth, and a lot of those things start from someone saying something from the crowd that really gets under the skin of one of the players, and most folks can walk that off, and others can't. And we've seen some very kind of confrontations that the Malice in the Palace most notably, but this can overflow into something very bad.
Well, and I think about it too, both in terms of, you know, the players who are on the receiving end of this hate and this racism, and also the fans who are in the stands who have to listen to this from people next to them. You know, if you're just there to listen to a game, particularly if you happen to reflect the slurs that the people next to you are throwing out, you know, what kind of an experience is that for you when you just want to show up and you want to watch some basketball?
For sure. Yeah, the WNBA has just recently launched its No Space for Hate campaign. So it'll be interesting to see how they sort of fold this situation in and move forward. Now, Chicago's football stadium saga, that continues. Mayor Johnson saying the Bears moving to Arlington Heights is not yet a done deal. Let's listen.
I've done everything that I possibly could do. I've done my part. You know, at this point, it's if the state of Illinois wants to keep the Bears in the city of Chicago, the football is in their... Hold on. Tommy's on the court. The ball is on the side of the field. You get the point.
The ball is on their gridiron. How about that?
So Mayor Johnson, it seems that Nick is throwing this back to state lawmakers. What's the chance that they're going to approve any funding for this new, shiny, lakefront. You're chuckling.
Oh, you crack
you
me up.
You don't think that it's going to happen.
I do not think it is going to happen on anywhere near the scale that the Bears and Mayor Johnson want to. You know, they've said maybe we would kick in some money, for example, infrastructure improvements if you put it around the Michael Reese site. Things like that mm-hmm. that would be of benefit both to the community, that would help, you know, this would be something that we could recoup, you know, with you know, all the benefits from having that in there for the tax base and tourism and blah, blah, blah. They're not kicking in billions of dollars. It's you know, they have made very clear, legislative leaders, the governor, have made clear this is not going to happen. And, you know, we've seen the Bears say that they have made significant progress with Arlington Heights.
Right.
You know, conversations with their new mayor out there who said, you know, he's open to some sort of a TIF district for things like infrastructure improvements. Still going to need a lot of money kicked in from the Bears, from the NFL. But mm-hmm. it seems like at this point, you know, Arlington Heights is back on the front burner.
Yeah. And the lakefront stadium is on ice, mm-hmm. on ice. Do you think that this might be a topic of discussion in Springfield next week, or are we just done?
You know, there was a proposal from a lawmaker from Arlington Heights that would freeze property tax assessments for these quote unquote mega projects, of which the new Bears Stadium and Entertainment District in Arlington Heights could potentially be one. So I will be watching to see whether that bill goes anywhere. Again, it's possible, it's an idea that they float and discuss now and don't do anything on, you know, during the spring session. We could see it come back up in the yeah. fall or, you know, in a future spring session.
And Bob, while the future of a new stadium for Chicago is in flux, Gary, Indiana announced that it is getting a new convention center, which is, of course, big boost for Northwest Indiana, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting to me. I mean, Gary, again, when I was kind of up and coming as a younger reporter and a crime reporter for that matter, I mean, Gary was, you know, called and maybe rightly so, the murder capital of the U.S. They had, you know, 100,000 people and 100 murders a year, or homicides. It was it's just insane. And you know, there are a lot of reasons for that. And Gary has sort of limped along since. Now, their past few years, I think it was maybe 3-4 years ago, they got a casino, the Hard Rock. A few years maybe before that, they had a minor league baseball team. It's still there, so they're trying stuff. They have not given up. Then again, the population, as Alden and I talked about earlier, you know, has plummeted. I mean, it's probably 50,000-60,000 down from what it was.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. 20, 30 years ago. Oh, yeah. It's
less.
Yes, because it was over, you know, 100,000, and now I think it's around 65, so which is still very sizable. And, yeah. you know, and the crime has at least the crime numbers have dropped reportedly. I mean, the last number I saw was last year they had 40 homicides. I mean, so that's still a hell of a lot, but that's not what it was at its tip. But then again, there are a lot fewer people there as well. But with that, all that as a backdrop, I mean, this is hopeful. You know, I mean, a convention center being located there, I think it's pretty much just adjacent mm-hmm. to the casino. But also there's another, you know, kind of thread here that, you know, worth a discussion maybe for another day, which is dependency on gaming revenues, right? Like a lot of towns, you know, defer to, you know, gambling and casinos as the savior and the saving grace. And, you know, again, Gary's maybe a little bit unique and,
yeah.
you know, they need kind of anything. But in general, you know, casinos are not necessarily always the saving grace that they're pitched to be.
Mm-hmm. As far as convention business, though, watch out McCormick Place, because Gary's only half hour south.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Some news about Chicago Public Media, which owns WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times. On Sunday, a special insert section in the Sun-Times produced by an outside company included a summer reading list. Now, the problem there was that it recommended books that don't actually exist. In fact, only 5 of the 15 titles on the list are actually real. There was no byline, but there's a Chicago freelance journalist who's taken responsibility for compiling this list using AI. I'm looking at you, Bob, because I know yeah. that you spent many years of your career teaching aspiring journalists over at Loyola. What happened this week, I feel, is very much a teachable moment. So what do you think are the top lessons here?
Yeah, I mean, it's just one more sign, first of all, that AI is permeating everything, or at least threatening to, and that includes our business, fortunately, and in this case, unfortunately, in this manner, certainly. My first job out of college was at a little historic wire service called City News Bureau of Chicago, which at the time was co-owned by the Trib and the Sun-Times. It had been around for 100 years and blah, 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 blah. And there was a sign on the wall when you walked in, and it was their sort of mantra. And I've never forgotten it, and I've used it to teach student journalists too, which is this: if your mother says she loves you, check it out. And you
fact
know,
check.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, check, you know, fact check, fact
so
check.
Even if you're harnessing AI to do some research for you, I mean, there, it's inexcusable not to double check to make sure that's correct.
Correct.
And
yeah.
So it's, you know, where does this go for newsrooms and not just ours in the future? I mean, you know, we used to have copy editors or more copy editors, certainly, that would look for commas and headlines and, you know, a bad word here and there, or, you know, just they were kind of our last catch-all for stopping errors or typos from getting into stories online or in the paper. I mean, I wonder whether we need copy editors more and more now for things like this.
Or maybe we stay away from AI for research purposes, right, Nick?
Well,
just short comments here.
Yeah, I mean, especially because this goes so far beyond research, it seems like these descriptions were generated by AI, which, by the way, was all trained on the kinds of materials that we all, you know, write and create. So it's, you know, it's sort of cannibalizing the work that we do and spitting out garbage.
Our CEO, Chicago Public Media CEO Melissa Bell, issued a statement, quote, "It's unacceptable that this content was inaccurate, and it's equally unacceptable that we did not make it clear to readers that the section was produced outside the Sun-Times newsroom." She also said that Chicago Public Media will be, quote, "reviewing our relationship with this national content partner to ensure mistakes of this nature no longer happen." We'll have to leave it there. That's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to WBEZ's Alden Lowry, Robert Hergeth of the Sun-Times, and WTTW's Nick Blumberg. Have a great long weekend.
Enjoy.
Hey, thanks.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Ari Mejia. The news cycle moves fast, so our weekly news recap gives us the opportunity to slow down. If you enjoy our recap as much as we do, well, consider leaving us a rating and liking this podcast. It helps us share these stories with more people in and around our city. Thanks for listening and have a restful weekend.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.